Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Tonight on our program, we ask how could proposed changes in federal funding impact teen pregnancy? U.S. teen pregnancy rates have fallen approximately 67% in the last 25 years. However, teen births remain higher than in other industrialized nations and result in significant social and economic repercussions. In addition, racial, socioeconomic, and geographic disparities exist despite the national decline in birth rates. To date, the Trump administration has been supportive of legislation weakening the Affordable Care Act's birth control mandate through religious exemptions. His budget proposes to eliminate the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program and deprive grant recipients across the country from over $200 million in research funding, while allotting nearly $280 million to abstinence-only education. The budget proposal also includes significant cuts to Medicaid funding to women's health providers, such as Planned Parenthood. Tonight we ask, could we see a reversal in the decline of adolescent pregnancies of the last 25 years? And what are some local and state strategies to close gaps in funding? Joining me in the studio tonight to discuss these issues and more are Dr. Claire Brindis. She's the director of the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies at UC San Francisco, executive director of the National Adolescent and Young Adult Health Information Center, associate director of the Public Policy Analysis and Education Center for Middle Childhood and Adolescent Health, and the director of the Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health at UCSF. She's also a professor in the Departments of Pediatrics and Obstetrics and Gynecology and Reproductive Sciences at UCSF. Welcome, Claire Brindis.
Thank you very much.
How do you do all that? We're also joined tonight in the studio by Lupe Rodriguez. She is the local director of public affairs for Planned Parenthood Marmonte and Planned Parenthood Advocates Marmonte. Previously, Lupe was the executive director at Access Women's Health Justice, an organization focused on removing barriers to sexual and reproductive health in California. Welcome, Lupe.
Thank you.
And we're also joined here in the studio by Dr. Sophia Yen, and she's a clinical associate professor in pediatrics and adolescent medicine at Stanford Hospitals and Clinics. She works at the Teen and Young Adult Clinic in Sunnyvale and is the CEO and co-founder of PandiaHealth.com, a birth control delivery company that also offers consultations for physicians. Welcome, Sophia.
Thank you so much for having me.
And joining me by phone, we have Heidi Winnick. She's a health educator, trainer, and the director of Bay Area Communities for Health Education, an organization that educates districts, schools, parents, and caregivers about the importance of comprehensive sexuality education and the requirements of the new California Education Code. Welcome, Heidi.
Thank you so much.
And, of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. And we'd like to alert you that some of the content of our program tonight will include sexual themes and language and may not be suitable for some of our younger listeners, so listener discretion is advised. Okay, so I wanted to start with you, Claire Brindis of UCSF. Why don't you take us back over the last 25 or so years and map out for us why we have seen such a decline in teen pregnancy rates in this country?
Well, that is a really important question, and frankly, I think it's one of the best successful public health campaigns that we've ever had in our country. Not very many other social issues have really been so affected by the availability of comprehensive sex education. But it isn't just an issue of having good sex education, because that is at the root, but it's not sufficient. We've also made major investments in having better access to birth control methods, and California has been a really progressive state as in terms of its making available to young people birth control services and their families, of course. But also, I would say a third major factor has been a recognition that if we don't give young people viable alternatives to early childbearing, that we're going to continue to have young people feel like that is their prime objective, or perhaps an area where they might fulfill some of their dreams and hopes and aspirations. So it's very difficult as a professional in the field for a very long time to see some of the trends in trying to undo the work that we've been doing. I also want to make a comment that in the sex education that's being offered, that we've also not just talked about the plumbing. The plumbing, I mean, you know, the just the organs and how the body works, but really putting it into the context of young people's lives and the kind of relationship negotiation skills they need to be able to communicate with their partners and to be able to be effective.
So of these three pieces of the strategy, access to contraception, comprehensive sexuality education, and
youth investments,
mm-hmm. Talking about how to look at sex and sexuality and relationships as part of a larger group of life choices. Is there a way you could sort of attribute to each one of these? How much have they, each one, impacted the teen pregnancy rates in the last quarter century?
I would say that it would be difficult to come up with a particular number. I can't
ballpark.
Say it's 33% to this and versus 33% in the other. But my sense about it is that it requires this whole combination. And what we have done is also used evaluation of programs to see which ones are effective. We've also invested in the kinds of teachers that we have in our schools who, in the past, many of the times, the stereotype was that it was the football coach who was stuck teaching this topic. And now I think that we've done a much better job of really trying to get very motivated young teachers, older teachers as well, and engaging not only the teachers and the school systems, but also parents. It's really surprising to me how in 2017 or in the last, you know, decade, we've encountered that there's still many parents out there who feel very much at dis-ease speaking about these topics, partly because they were never spoken with about these topics themselves, and they weren't raised with some of this knowledge. And consequently, when they see their young children reach the adolescent years, sometimes they don't have the skills. And so some of the programs have really tried to improve that.
And so you mentioned again that these three strategies kind of really work together. Take us back again to when this set of initiatives started. What was the public health and political and cultural climate of our country at that time?
Well, it's an interesting question because while we sometimes are seeing that this problem or this issue is controversial, actually back in 1970 when Title X, which is the federal program that supports family planning for low-income populations, including adolescents, was signed into law, it was a bill that was proposed by our first George Bush, and it was signed into law by President Nixon. So in the 70s, this topic was not controversial. And in fact, there was this commitment to making information available to young people and having them have those options and those choices in their lives. Over time, though, I would say that sex education has gotten to be in the challenging position of having to defend itself. And there are many people in the country who are fearing that if you bring up these topics to young people, that somehow you're condoning having sex or you're putting ideas into young people's minds about having sex. And one only has to look at our whole society to see that we use sex to sell every object, whether it's something on in the television, the movies, etc. And we've been really caught in this crossfire of using this topic as a controversial twist that somehow needs to be resolved because of the fact that information is not dangerous and knowledge is not dangerous. And in fact, our research points out that the more knowledge and information young people have, the wiser choices they're able to make.
So, Sophia Yen of Stanford, when it comes to teens, preteens, and sexuality, tell us what's actually happening out there. Let's break open some myths and misconceptions that may be lingering about the appropriateness of sex education in schools and at what age it should start and that.
Yes. So we're seeing down in the Peninsula South Bay that there are parents that are new immigrants or Chinese Americans or different ethnicities that are coming forward and protesting these comprehensive sex education for fear that this information will lead to action. And the research has shown that when you're given information, you're more likely to be protected when you have it, and you're more likely to be aware of the dangers. Whereas without that information, you will have a higher risk of sexually transmitted infections. What we're seeing out there, and I want parents to know, is that 30% of high school freshmen nationally have had sex.
What age is that?
That is 13. 13. And my daughter is 11. So I get that deep in my heart. But it's 1 in 3. So not like 1 in 10, not 1 in 20, 1 in 3. And then the way I remember the rest of the statistics is 1 in 10 will convert every year. So it's 30%, 40%, 50%, 60%, roughly. And so I teach all the pediatricians that come through our training program at Stanford, you need to spray everyone prophylactically with the knowledge of emergency contraception, their right to confidential reproductive health care, because you can't predict which 1 in 10 is going to convert. And I want to prevent unplanned pregnancies. I want to prevent HIV. But this is real. And parents can't stick their heads in the ground and cover their ears and say, nah, 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 because it's going to happen. And as Dr. Brenda said, it's all over the TV. I had one parent, I sat through 2 hours of parents going on every 2 minutes of how they were against sex ed. And one parent came up and said, my 7th grade daughter saw 50 Shades of Grey, and she came home and she was just absolutely silent. And I was like, yes, this is why you need the sex ed, to prepare her when she sees these things. Because without it, she's going to get that one-sided, totally skewed, wrong point of view that shows women like to be abused or tossed around and stuff, when we want to talk about consent and we want to talk about what's good and positive as opposed to just media. Because if you don't talk about it, media is not going to stop talking about it.
And as a pediatrician, what has changed about parenting styles that has also led to this this change perhaps in comfort level around kids receiving sex education in school?
I think it's not so much a change necessarily in parenting styles, though I do see a lot more helicopter parenting. Remember back in our day, we all walked to school. Nobody walks to school anymore. I walked to school in 1st and 2nd grade. If I did that now, maybe I'd be accused of child abuse. But what is there is the internet. And you can't control when and where your child will access the internet. So even if you have the best controls, your child's friend whips out a phone, you can't block that because you can't control your friend's child. Or they go to the school library and the school library isn't blocked. Or they go to the general library, or they just, you know, there's so much more information out there. And if we don't provide the good information that's evidence-based, age-appropriate, which is required by law, then you have the unfettered, crazy media other side, which is selling sex, 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 as Dr. Brenda said.
And you mentioned something. Some of these opinions, do they vary by socioeconomic status, by racial ethnic group? Say more about that.
I think it's acculturation. Is really, the longer you've been in this country, the more you realize how much sex is here. And back in my day, it was like, don't ask, don't tell, just get it taken care of. But more I'm seeing in the South Bay, my kid doesn't have sex. It's those other kids that have sex. My kid doesn't need this information. But I'm betting you, if I kicked you out of the room, which I do with all of our patients, and ask your young person, I'm going to find that 30% that is sexually active. And God forbid it is your kid, and they didn't get the way to prevent unplanned pregnancy. They didn't get the information to prevent HIV or HPV, or you didn't let me give them the HPV vaccine. Your child will end up pregnant. Your child will end up with a sexually transmitted infection. So it's about prevention. And the way I pitch it to some Asian American parents is that if your child's not having sex, at least they can know the biology and the information that'll help them be a pre-med.
And then is the focus here on girls, boys, both?
I think that it is in this case actually gender neutral, but I think in society in general we have a stigma against women and they're slut shaming versus the guy is the stud, but if a woman does anything then she is, you know, dirty and shameful. And I find it interesting that parents say sex is bad, sex is evil, save it for the one you love. And then I absolutely believe in abstinence plus, which is comprehensive sex ed plus abstinence, or what I call again born again abstinence. But I don't believe in abstinence only, which is you can only talk about birth control in terms of its failures and that you have to abstain until marriage. Because the average age of marriage or having a first child in this country is 26. What are the odds your kid's going to hold off from 13 to 26? And if you yourself personally didn't abstain, how can you hold that standard for your teenager? Teenagers hate hypocrisy.
Hmm. And Lupe Rodriguez of Planned Parenthood, how do you see teen pregnancy? How do you think about it when you look at all the comprehensive services that Planned Parenthood provides?
Well, at Planned Parenthood, a big part of the work that we do is sex education. And across a spectrum of different services and programs that we offer. And speaking to the question of, you know, parents and making them comfortable with talking to their children about sex or their adolescents and other offspring, we offer parent-child communication workshops at Planned Parenthood that help us, you know, teach parents and guardians and others who work with young people how to speak to them. As was mentioned, a lot of parents and guardians don't know or don't feel comfortable doing that or have other kinds of stigmas or ideas or perhaps are in denial in a lot of ways about whether or not their kids are having sex. And so these workshops enable us to kind of break down those barriers between kids and parents and really kind of, as Dr. Yen mentioned, sort of talk to them about the stats. I mean, 30% of young of incoming freshmen are having sex, and that's a really important thing that we talk to them about, so breaking that down. We also offer a peer education programming, so to Dr. Brindis's point about ensuring that there are interventions that go beyond just sex education in the classroom and sort of the basics of how to protect yourself and what's what, you know, anatomy. We talk about, you know, healthy relationships and work with young people who want to be peer educators or want to educate folks at their schools or programs about how to talk to their peers. And that's been really effective because we find that, you know, young people may or may not listen entirely to teachers or to adults, but if a young person is equipped with the information in their school, the correct information, then they're able to share it amongst themselves and thereby propagate correct information. And then, of course, as I mentioned, we do peer sex education programming in school. So we're part of those you know, the classroom intervention that happens. Public schools in California as of 2015 have to provide by law comprehensive, age-appropriate, and medically accurate sex education curriculum for their students. And so we're part of our education team at Planned Parenthood is a part of both going into classrooms directly and doing those presentations and doing those classes, and also teaching teachers about how to do them and how to do them correctly and working with them to build their capacity in that, because many teachers aren't trained in that when they go into teaching.
And what percentage of your clients are teens that are coming to you for contraception?
That's a great question. So last fiscal year, about 16% were 19 and younger, and 67% of our patients were 20 to 34. So about 19% of our patient base and client base are 19 and younger.
Yeah. And so back to you, Claire Brindis, how does California compare to the rest of the country when it comes to advances in the reductions of unwanted teen pregnancies?
Well, I'm really proud to be a Californian. It may be surprising to you and your listeners that one out of eight adolescents in the U.S. lives in California. So if California is doing a good job in terms of reducing its adolescent childbearing, it means that the rest of the country also benefits. So we have been really at the forefront in terms of as you mentioned earlier, about a two-thirds reduction. But I also want to point out that this reduction has been happening also among Latina and young women, as also African-American. You are very correct that there are amazing, tremendous disparities in our country and in our state. And we know that teen pregnancy often places these young people at great risk. The fact that I think a lot of Latinas and African Americans are now beginning to see some positive role models places California, I would say, also at the forefront of the fact that there are viable reasons why one should navigate their teen years to be child-free.
And so, but the gap remains.
And the gap remains, and so, for example, While the Latinos have experienced a 50% decline, they represent about 38 births per 1,000. For blacks, it's about 35, and for whites, it's about 17 per 1,000. So we still are seeing the disparities. And I, among all of your guests tonight, am one who says we can't just sit on our behinds with the idea that we've made some incredible progress. Every year, we have a whole new generation of young people who are entering their adolescent years. And so we know that we have to really support those young people as they come into adolescence, but also that we need to support young people throughout their adolescence and into their young adulthood, because these are really important issues, and oftentimes we don't talk about them enough.
So you mentioned that more positive role models are helping Latinas and African American black girls avoid teen pregnancy. What's contributing to the gap?
Well, the gap, I would say, there's still a huge issue around poverty and inequality and institutionalized racism that we've been dealing with on a variety of other political arenas. And my sense is that for many of these young women living in very high poverty communities, those pathways to success may not be as clear. So we are very fortunate that in California we have a network of public clinics such as Planned Parenthood, but also a variety of private doctor's offices. And Sophia will share with you some of her exciting work in this area as well. But my sense is that there's still inequalities in terms of access, and there's still inequalities in terms of the relationships that many of these young people are coming from. If they have been in foster care, for example, that's a population that's very much at high risk, and California does have a very significant number of foster care youth. If you're homeless, runaway, if you have very unstable settings in which you grow up, not enough food to eat, et cetera, I think oftentimes those are the factors that people are thinking about. And they may turn to a relationship because it provides some kind of loving stability that they may not be feeling elsewhere. And unfortunately, sometimes they don't recognize that that's perhaps a short-term answer for longer-term parts of their lives. The other comment that I just want to make is it may be surprising to you how much myth information exists out there. And in our research, I'm still surprised when young people say, well, I couldn't get pregnant the first time I had sex, or I couldn't get pregnant if I stood up. But most recently, I heard of a young woman who told me that her boyfriend was drinking Mountain Dew, and as a result of the acidity in Mountain Dew, somehow it was affecting the sperm of this young man. Well, honestly, even with the amount of comprehensive sex education that's available, we have to overcome some of the myths that young people have. And where do these come from? We're not quite sure.
Mm. You mentioned access, and I imagine you mean access to contraception is a barrier here, no pun intended, in the rates, the disparities amongst Latinas and African-American girls and with respect to teen pregnancy rates. What does that say, Sophia Yen, about the healthcare delivery system?
So I love Family Pack, but it is still limited that you have to go into a clinic. And so one is finding transportation. Two is, as they shut down clinics, such as they've done in Texas, it could be, you know, hours away from your nearest provider. And so that's one of the reasons I started Pandia Health, was to bring birth control wherever you have internet in a mailbox. One, for confidentiality, because you can envision if you're in a small town like Visalia and you have to go in there and ask for your birth control every month, if the pharmacist has an opinion, he can be like, oh, you, Sophia, again, for birth control. And then everyone in Visalia, by the end of that visit, knows what you were there for. And so it's not so confidential. But the other thing is access. I'm really proud that my company has served people that are 2 or 3 hours away from the nearest provider, the nearest pharmacy, and then just women wasting their time every single month going to the pharmacy. If you have 2 children and 2 jobs, when do you have time to run to the pharmacy or go to a Family Pack provider? You may not have that time, but you need that birth control. And so with Pandia Health, our idea is no one runs out of birth control on our watch. And we've also brought down barriers of cost. Family Pack is amazing. But if you can't access Family Pack and sign up for it, we've taken the cost from an unknown $150 to $750 for a doctor's visit down to $39 $9 to get an evaluation for birth control and have that prescribed. And then if you have insurance, we bill it to you and it's a free service. If it's not, birth control on average is about $20 a month per pack, which is about $240 a year, which is still cheaper than a doctor's visit of unknown costs. It could be $500 to $750.
But how often can teens really afford that or navigate that?
Yes. So not so much for the teenagers. We've seen more like 23-year-olds accessing our services, but we intend to go national and we intend to be staffed by adolescent medicine specialists who will know the laws in each state. If they sign up for Family Pact, we take Family Pact, and then it would be free for the medication. The $39 fee, we do have a Pandia Health Birth Control Fund that's a nonprofit that people can donate to cover other people's costs, and we definitely are offering scholarships for those people.
And the other part is there some disparity in who's being offered contraception when they do go to the doctor? When do doctors bring it up? I'm just curious, what is the role of the healthcare delivery system in making sure that those barriers are broken down?
So as a physician training future pediatricians, we try to train them that once somebody develops breast buds, which could be 8 years old, but in general, we at least at age 12, we kick the parents out of the room and talk about what I call sex, drugs, rock and roll. And the rock and roll is mental health, and the sex is sex. And so we want to make sure that the young person knows what their rights are to confidential reproductive health care, to tell them about emergency contraception, to tell them about their options if it hasn't been covered by comprehensive sex ed or others. However, what I've seen is that if you're going to your city, you know, physician that sees your mom and your brother and your auntie, or the receptionist happens to be your auntie, then that doctor may not provide those services, especially depending on the age of that physician, as well as the training. So if they weren't trained in the United States, if they weren't trained recently when they were required to have an adolescent medicine rotation, or just personally, it's I've heard stories of doctors that say, I'm not going to prescribe that to you, or you're a good girl, you don't need that, do you? And making those assumptions, I just, you know, provide everybody the same care, the same opportunities, but not every physician's going to do that. And we hope that they would, but...
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing teen pregnancy prevention with our guests here in the studio, Dr. Claire Brindis, the director of the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies at UC San Francisco, Lupe Rodriguez, the local director of public affairs for Planned Parenthood Marmonte, and Dr. Sophia Yen, a clinical associate professor in pediatrics and adolescent medicine at Stanford Hospital and Clinics and CEO and co-founder of PandiaHealth.com, a birth control delivery company. And in a moment, we'll be joined by Heidi Winnick of the Bay Area Communities for Health Education. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. How is sexual education being addressed in your child's schools, and what are your thoughts on sexual education in California schools? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Heidi Winnick, I wanted to bring you into the conversation. A little earlier, Lupe Rodriguez was talking about California law that is mandating certain standards for comprehensive sexual education in California schools. Tell us, how are we doing as a state with that?
How are districts doing in terms of getting into compliance?
Yes.
That's a great question. We're slowly but surely kind of trying to keep track of all of that as we go. We're working across the state right now with many, many districts to try to find out exactly what they're doing and to support them to implement high-quality, medically accurate, and age-appropriate comprehensive sex education. And there's lots of great resources out there for them. There are a bunch of new curricula. As was mentioned earlier, you know, it is mandated in middle school and in high school. And so there are a bunch of new curricula that are evidence-based that have been shown to be effective in reducing the sexual onset, and also when young people do decide that they are ready to have sex, that they're more able to talk to their partners and stuff like that. So there are great curricula out there, and districts can either purchase them, or they could work with a community-based organization like a Planned Parenthood and hire their health educators to come into their schools. And so we're seeing, you know, slowly but surely, some schools and some districts were already in compliance and doing a great job, you know, from before. And some schools were doing really nothing, and some schools were doing really negative jobs and doing kind of illegal, abstinence-only education. So I think we're definitely seeing trends move in the right direction. It's hard to say exactly who's doing, you know, what where, but we're slowly but surely kind of collecting that information as we work with more and more districts.
All right. And Claire Brindis, I wanted to go back to you for a moment and talk about what's at stake here. Right, the intro to the program, the impetus for tonight's program is really talking about proposed cuts to all of this work that you've been describing, that our guests have been describing tonight. Why don't you, again, encapsulate for us what's at stake here?
Okay.
In terms of the cuts that are proposed.
Well, this is a particularly challenging time, I would say, for women's reproductive health across the whole lifespan. And I want to break your question into two elements. One has to do with the funding that is at stake around federal funding for evidence-based programs. The Office of Adolescent Health, as you indicated before, has just yanked funding from 81 programs across the country, representing about $213 million. And these dollars are anticipated to be redeployed to be committed to abstinence-only programs. The evidence points that abstinence-only education is not as effective as comprehensive that includes. We're not against abstinence, but we're indicating that abstinence alone is insufficient. So one major risk that is already happening is that the unraveling of the programs, for example, that Lupe is running or that Heidi's involved in, they won't have enough federal and state dollars to be able to continue this kind of education. On the other hand, the other risk is the lack of funding for access to contraceptives. One of the very important guideposts and successes as part of the Affordable Care Act, or some people call it Obamacare, is that what that was built into the ACA, into the DNA of the ACA, was a commitment to prevention. And I had the supreme honor of serving on the Institute of Medicine committee that made the recommendations around women's preventive services, including not having to pay out of your pocket for birth control. In 2016, over 55 million women, we don't know how many teenagers, but over 55 million women were able to access contraceptives without having to worry about whether paying for food this month had to be at odds with paying for birth control. So consequently, even getting long-acting reversible contraceptives was a benefit that was available. There is a challenge that even now, with the initial defeat of the healthcare reform, which would have eliminated that benefit, that there's still going to be efforts by our Department of Health and Human Services to eliminate that benefit for women across the country. Part of what's driving that energy or negative energy is the belief that the federal government should not be involved in the provision of contraceptives to women. And yet, in the research we've conducted, cost-benefit analysis, showing that for every dollar that we invest in family planning, the federal government and the state government saves over $5. There are very few programs where I can give you that return on investment. So I worry about this double-edged sword. Eliminate the information and education that young people and other age people need, as well as eliminate their access to birth control.
And what we haven't said so far in the conversation is why are we trying to prevent teen pregnancy? I mean, maybe it's a no-brainer, but why? I mean, because you brought up the dollars argument just now, so it made me wonder, you know, what are the reasons here?
Well, I can start the list, and I think, Lupe, if you want to...
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'll say that one of the major concerns is we have, and we have shown, is that young women who have an unintended or mistimed pregnancy tend not to accept the fact that they were pregnant or seek prenatal care. And so many of their births are to low birth weight babies that require a tremendous amount of investments, both in terms of family investments as well as societal investments, medical investments. But beyond the birthing process, there's the whole potential risk of lifelong risks from having a low birth weight baby. And then I think, Lupe, if you want to talk about educational outcomes, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Young women who have unintended pregnancies at an adolescent age tend to have lower rates of high school graduation and thereby lower rates of higher education. For example, one of the programs that we offer at Planned Parenthood supports young women who have experienced an unplanned pregnancy in adolescence and their partners, and supports them in getting back on track, so to speak, to get a high school education and then a college education. We find that about for young women across the board who experience an unintended pregnancy, they have about a 60% chance of graduating from high school. And through programs like Teen Success and the programs that we run and other organizations run that work with them to build their self-esteem, to build a support network around them, they're able to increase that rate to about 87% graduation from high school. And so that's one of the biggest issues that we see, and certainly something that continues sort of cycles of poverty that we see where, as Dr. Brindis mentioned, poverty is one of the biggest factors in unintended pregnancy, especially for young people who may have access to birth control or may have limited access because of that. But I think poverty sort of builds a lot of barriers and builds a lot of problems around people's lives that, that lead or tend to lead a little bit more to unintended pregnancies. And we find that, trying to break that cycle of poverty is one way to support that. And so education is certainly one of the biggest issues that we see with young people experiencing unintended pregnancy or lack of education.
So far we've talked about the impact on the mothers or the parents. How about the children? What impacts? You mentioned low birth weight, which can have lifelong effects.
Right.
What are some other?
Well, some of the other effects really deal with having educational learning disabilities and learning problems that also impact how successful they will be in classroom learning. We also know that poor educational outcomes for these children often lead to other kinds of risk-taking behaviors, including substance use or alcohol use or other mental health issues. So my sense is that it's not a problem that is just a short-term issue, but it really has a lifelong consequences for the mom, the partner, as well as the child and other family members. And so, again, I see more and more parents indicating that they don't want their children to have this experience as they are teens, but oftentimes feel somehow if they gave them information or education that it might change their perspective.
And we have a caller who wants to ask that very question in just a moment. But first, let me reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing teen pregnancy prevention with our guest, Dr. Claire Brindis of UC San Francisco, Guadalupe Rodriguez, also known as Lupe, Planned Parenthood Marmonte, Heidi Winnig, the Director of Bay Area Communities for Health Education, and Dr. Sophia Yen of Stanford Hospital and Clinics, and CEO and co-founder of PandiaHealth.com. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Again, 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So let's go to Susie from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Sorry if my reception is a little spotty. Thanks for having my call. Just to let you know, I think I have a 12-year-old, and I found it to be really difficult when she was in fifth grade. So my 12-year-old is in fifth grade, and they were being taught sex ed from a variety of perspectives, and I felt it was a far overreach. I think eighth grade is a more appropriate for which to inform in a school setting. I'm also teaching my daughter to abstain for as long as possible because we're really college-bound in our family. And I'd really like to just share that, like, if kids want to get condoms, they can go to Walgreens if they're going to be bound on sex, you know, like, hell-bent on going for it. But fifth grade, informing them, empowering them, totally opposed to it. Just a conservative SF-based native here sharing my opinion.
And tell us what was hard for you when you learned that your daughter was learning about this in fifth grade.
Well, they were just a little bit, they're all very fidgety. It was really inappropriate, I think, cognitively, in terms of cognitive development. A lot of them were not mature enough to handle that content. None of them, to my knowledge, were planning on going and having sex with one another or, you know, they're young. We're talking fifth grade here, people. I think it's totally socially irresponsible to be empowering them as if it's a cool thing to do. Now, I understand definitely protection-wise and preventing adolescent, you know, and premature pregnancy, but planting those seeds of ideas so early in little minds is a problem. You know, their hormones are developing in sixth and seventh grade. I think eighth grade is a more appropriate age to do that, definitely. Hmm. And I think it's the parents' job to inform their kids about this subject matter. What if you guys jump the gun and get to it before we do? That's so, so hard then to have to kind of clean up the pieces if we have different views, you know? Hmm. It shouldn't be taught in schools, in my opinion, at all until eighth grade. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your call. So, Sophia Yen, let's go to you there. What goes through your mind as you hear Susie's comments?
So just going back to the law in California, my understanding is it's middle school and high school and not necessarily the fifth grade. And all of the mandated education has to be age appropriate and medically accurate. So I definitely have heard from most parents, my belief is that when you survey them, and Heidi could probably speak to this, 80% of parents want sex ed taught in schools. Many parents are uncomfortable, and when they teach sex ed, they always let parents opt out. And so if parents want to discuss this, I always tell parents, you have your kids 24/7 and 365 days of the year. And when I kick them out for my personal private conversation with the young person, again, if you are buddies with your friend, I'm not going to find out anything you didn't know. And if you want to talk about it, you have every right to talk to your kid 24/7 when they send that letter out at the beginning of the school year until, you know, that curriculum is there. And you have the right to review the curriculum. And so if there's anything you don't like in it, you definitely could speak out. And I absolutely believe in promoting abstinence as much as possible. But I'm also realistic that 30% of high school students will be active. And I think the reason they bring it up in fifth grade is simply for a lot of young women get their periods. And so you have to at least address menstruation around that time.
Yeah, can I add that there are programs.
Yes,
thank you. There are programs that are offered in elementary school and middle school at different schools. But as Dr. Yen mentioned, parents can opt out, and they are offered information and consent letters at the beginning of the year to be able to opt out of those programs if they're being offered at their schools. And so, you know, I think that for parents like our caller who are concerned or afraid. They can certainly, you know, look at those letters. They can opt their children out if they don't want to be a part of it. And they can call their schools. And as Dr. Yen mentioned, they can review their curriculums. But there are programs, so I will say that. But definitely part of the state law that passed in 2015 mandates that these things are age appropriate and that every curriculum that's offered at the different
age. But it sounds
levels,
like every
yeah.
person has a different definition of what's age appropriate. But staying mm-hmm. with you, Lupe, because you mentioned that some of your work is workshops to help mm-hmm. Teens and parents communicate around this issue. How would you talk with Susie about how she can discuss with her daughter when she has conflict with what's being taught at school? Let's just say, well, mm-hmm. she obviously didn't pull her child out, right. or she didn't say she did, at least. How do you counsel parents to mm-hmm. to engage, even if there's a disagreement?
Well, I think that, you know, we present to them the curriculum that is offered and that is state, written by the state, basically, and has, you know, all of the sort of different recommendations throughout the ages to parents in these workshops. And we talk to them about, you know, what they feel comfortable with in the curriculum. Do they understand it themselves? So you sort of start with a baseline with parents about where they are themselves on sort of sex education and anatomy and that kind of thing. You know, you talk to them about what their relationship is like with their children. I think that's a really important part of it. If it sounded like the caller maybe does have a good relationship and is able to want to speak to her child and wants to speak to her child, we encourage that. We encourage that the parents be very present with their children, that they ask them questions very early on, that they use medically accurate terms for their bodies, for their anatomy very early on, that they talk to them about consent very early on as children so that they get the ball rolling in those conversations. We have parents that come to us later on in their children's, you know, age when they actually see that maybe the kids are starting to ask more questions. But if we're able to talk to parents who have children who are younger in elementary school, we sort of give them tips on how to start those conversations if the child hasn't asked anything. So I think that's first. And making sure to say that, yes, they are a very important part of all of this work, that certainly, you know, sex education in schools is not the end-all be-all of this education, and that parents play a really, really vital role in supporting, their children and the decisions that they make. So, glad to hear that the caller is really, interested in this topic and wants to talk to her children. We recommend that, you know, if she wants to learn more about what we offer in that realm, she can give us a call or come to our website, ppmarmonte.org.
And I also wanted to comment that Susie really presented her values. She'd shared about the fact that her family is a college-oriented family. And I would say that all of us would be very supportive of her continuing to share the values of what she's hoping, what the aspirations are of her daughter's continuation with her education. Education is a really great contraceptive, but I think it's a matter of really understanding and having the tools to be able to say no successfully and to be able to negotiate with a boyfriend, that her mom knows who she's hanging out with. Does she have other kinds of rules and regulations about coming home a certain time? Is there oversight, a positive sense of oversight rather than a helicopter parent?
Right. And just one last question, Lupe, before we move on. How much of these parent-teen conversations are initiated by the teen dragging the parent to your organization or the parent bringing their child?
It's very often the parent bringing. Kids tend to be a little bit more squeamish about, you know, hearing their parents or being in the same room. But we've done presentations where, college-bound young people are in the same room with their parents, and we kind of just facilitate conversation. So we do a variety of things. But the parents, as Dr. Brenda said, as Dr. Yen said, always want to be involved or often want to be involved and are very interested in supporting their children and making the best decisions.
Mm. Can I throw in two resources?
Yeah, I was going to get Heidi in here. Go ahead.
To say a few things. We also do parent workshops and what everybody said I so resonate with. One of the things that has been so important in our work is to do parent workshops with parents of younger children, because what happens, as we all know, as teens or tweens start growing up, is they still want to hear from their parents, even though they say they don't want to, but they really want to hear from their parents when they're young. And so if a parent can establish that kind of close relationship, we always talk about being askable and being accepting, unconditionally accepting, meaning like, whatever you tell me, I will always love you. And whatever question you ask me, if I don't know the answer, I will help you find the answer. And so if parents can establish that kind of rapport and that kind of communication at a very young age, when the child gets to be a tween or gets to be a teen and is, you know, saying, giving you the talk to the hand kind of thing, first of all, as a parent, I still think they do listen to us, by the way, even though they say they don't want to. But second of all, when we've established ourselves as having actually fact-based information and being somebody that they can turn to, I think they are more likely to be able to, you know, to listen to us, even if they're in the car saying, oh, Mom, come on. And then, you know, the other thing I wanted to say based on what the caller called in, usually in fifth grade or in elementary school, the education is around puberty and around body changes and around healthy friendships. And I think so often we have this idea, oh, sex ed is about sex. Well, it's about sexuality. It can start, you know, in kindergarten when you say to, you know, your young child, if grandma comes over and wants to hug you and you don't want to hug her, you can say, it's okay, I don't want to hug right now, but I'll give you a high five. Or it starts by saying, you know, I don't want to, consent can be taught to a preschooler, right? You say, I don't want to play puzzles with you right now, but I do want to play dollies. It's the same sentence as, I don't want to have sex with you, but I will kiss you, or I will go to the movies with you. You just fill in the blank based on what age your child is, right? So all of these kind of skills and all of this kind of important communication, really, really, it's important to start at a young age. And I think that the more we can do that, the more we set up and scaffold for our teenagers and for our young adults, that we're open and able to kind of communicate with them. And one of my real gurus in this field, Deborah Rothman, talks about this concept of anticipatory guidance. And I think especially now, I mean, it was mentioned earlier about the media and you know, studies are showing now that children as young as 8 and 9 are seeing porn and on their phones or on their parents' phones. And, you know, I can't tell you how many stories I have of young kids, parents telling me, oh, their child was trying to Google sparkly tights on Amazon, but they misspelled tights and they got something really different, right? And or somebody, a teacher at a school that I was working at, told me that she Googled whale tail because she wanted to teach her students about whales, and that, you know, not knowing that that was a slang for, you know, it's a slang for seeing a song, somebody's song coming out of their pants. And that was shown to her second graders, you know, and there's no parental control or no school block against that kind of stuff. So if we're not talking to our kids about what's out there and about all the messages that they're getting on a regular basis anyway, and we're kind of pretending that somehow they're going to be able to make sense of those messages without, you know, without coming to us, if we're too uncomfortable with it, we're really setting them up for expectations that are totally unreasonable and expectations that are often, you know, sexist, misogynistic, violent, and really kind of what's put out there as entertainment, right, not as reality.
All right, I want to get to a couple of calls here. We have Sonia from San Jose. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Thank you. I just wanted to say, as a parent, I have a 12-year-old, that I'm all for comprehensive sex education. My daughter started in Mountain View in fifth grade, learning about puberty, learning about healthy relationships. It opened the door for conversations at home. And I am a young mom. I had her when I was 19. Our family is completely educated. My mother was an immigrant here, received her her master's degree, and but she never talked to me about sex. And I think being a young mom and not having those resources, that topic being taboo, I didn't have the right information in front of me. I wish I had all the resources I could have had. So now that I'm a mother of two daughters, I'm all about knowledge. I'm all about empowerment. And from a public health perspective, it's important that we educate our children about not just sexuality, but about healthy relationships, about sexual orientation, and really opening that knowledge pool that's vital, especially since technology is at the tip of their fingers and they can believe anything. So I'm all for you guys. I appreciate your work that you do here in California and in the Bay.
Thank you so much, Sonia, for your call. Let's go next to Nancy from Berkeley. Nancy, welcome to the program.
I'm a 78-year-old grandma, and I am totally for sex education. I think it should start in the schools in kindergarten and, you know, just do it age-appropriate. And these moms or dads who think, you know, that, oh, God, sex education, you know, the kids are going to start being sexually active because of it, or, you know, they don't want their kids to know. I mean, it's the evangelicals whose kids... percentage of the most pregnant girls, because they don't know anything, and knowledge makes you free. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't do terrible things to you. And I just really believe that when my, you know, when my daughter was 16 and she wanted to have sex with her boyfriend, I took her and, you know, got her birth control, and I said, if you're gonna do it at home. And neither of my kids ever got pregnant or got anybody else pregnant. And, you know, I think that I'm all for sex education.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much for your call. We have a couple of emails and tweets here. We have a tweet saying age appropriate is defined by law. Do they have the cognitive ability, I mean children, to grasp the topic, not subject to opinion but law? Any thoughts there, and how this gets determined, what's age appropriate?
More understanding.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Heidi.
Yeah, please.
Well, I was going to say, and I also can defer to Dr. Brindis too, but I would just mention that there are a number of different bodies. There's a California state health standards that come out from the CDE and from other California, you know, education organizations, and then there's also two really great national organizations, SECIS, which stands for Sexuality Information and Education Council of the U.S., and also FOSSE, which stands for Future of Sex Ed. Both have research-based, evidence-based national guidelines for sexuality education. And so these, it's not just like some teachers kind of deciding, oh, what do I feel like teaching my fifth graders today? It's all of this education, at least should be, very much grounded in these standards, just in the same way that there's standards for math or standards for English or standards for social studies. So so that's one thing. And, you know, again, I think this is the key for parents to get involved, know what's being taught. As was mentioned, you know, it's the parents' right to be able to go to the school and see what's being taught and ask about it and understand. And so if for some reason the education that your child is getting you don't feel is appropriate for your own child, you can opt your child out. Or if you feel like the education is lacking, you can talk to your school and try to get better education in there, because I think it's really the parents and the schools that have to work together. The schools, you know, as a health educator, we can provide fact-based, you know, completely unbiased education, and we can refer our young people back to their parents or to their clergy or to their trusted adults to try to understand the values. But the parents have such a key role of not only teaching the facts, but also teaching their own values, their own family and cultural values, and also setting limits. And we know that young people desperately need limits. So if the parents are, the school can't do that. That's not the school's job. So the school can provide the facts, and then the parents at home need to circle that with values and with limits.
All right. So we just have like a few more minutes in the program. So Claire Brindis, what happens if some of these proposed cuts go through? I want to hear from you globally what you think, and then from you, Lupe, what would happen to organizations like yours? So first, Claire Brindis.
Well, looking into the crystal ball, I worry about the defunding of the educational programs throughout the U.S., primarily because those programs are at the cutting edge. That is, yes, there is a body of evidence and there is a body of science, but it's not like, it's like all other kinds of science. We continue to build on it. So my concern is that some of the most innovative practices for the next generation of young people may be really chilled and may not have an opportunity to grow creatively. And secondly, in terms of the access to birth control, I worry deeply because this current administration is bent on elimination of the Title X program and elimination of these... Which funds family planning programs for low-income populations across the country, and also eliminating this essential benefit. And at the same time, the one area of optimism is that there is a commitment in a number of states, and there's also a desire by many health insurance companies to be competitive, so that even though the federal government may weaken the boundaries or weaken the requirements of having birth control as an essential benefit, they may still continue to have it just as a means of maintaining their market share.
Mm-hmm. And Lupe Rodriguez,
yeah,
what are you looking at?
Planned Parenthood, we would be greatly affected by cuts to Title X. Many of the education programs that we provide or are able to subsidize for certain school districts or provide in a subsidized way are funded by Title X. We also provide education inside the health centers with patients who come to us for birth control about their options, and those things would be severely impacted. And then with the sort of larger cuts that are being threatened around Medicaid and specifically the carving out of Planned Parenthood from the Medicaid program, about 84% of our patients in California and about 87% nationally depend on Medicaid funding to be able to come to Planned Parenthood. And so that would be devastating for our ability to provide health care in general, and it can mean health center closures and access, lack of access.
All right. And Sophia Yen, you get the last word. You said you had a couple of resources to share with folks.
Yes. I always like to have people walk away with a couple pearls. So with respect to resources that are easily available and generally low priced, one, take advantage of when you have your kid in your car with you. That's an opportunity to have an awkward conversation without having to look them eye to eye. So you're driving and they're in the back seat and you can just throw out stuff and talk about stuff. Two, for the younger women, The Care and Keeping of You by American Girl. Generally, I'm not into pushing products by particular commercial companies, but this is a really well-written book on puberty and body changes, and it has one of the best descriptions of how to use a tampon out there. And then lastly, a TV show to watch or to discuss with your young person is East Los High. I love how it's impregnated with sex ed points and discussion points about sexting and about emergency contraception. contraception.
Great. We'll put all of those on our website. Well, that's our program for this evening. There were many more tweets and emails that we couldn't get to. So thanks and calls. And thanks to all of you who did try to participate on our program tonight. We obviously need to bring this topic back soon. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Claire Brindis of UC San Francisco, Lupe Rodriguez of Planned Parenthood Marmonte, and Heidi Winnick of Bay Area Communities for Health Education, and Dr. Sophia Yen of Stanford Hospital and Clinics. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Jean Marie Achituro, and tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Join me next week as we talk about the intersection between victims' rights and criminal justice reform. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night. Have a great week. Can well